Coming up on this week's book show, New York Times bestselling author Sue Miller's insightful new novel focuses on marriage, love, family, happiness, and sorrow. Monogamy is the story of Annie and Graham, happily married for 30 years, but after Graham dies suddenly, Annie discovers he was having an affair. Sue Miller on this week's book show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. New York Times bestselling author Sue Miller's new novel focuses on marriage, love, family, happiness, and sorrow. Monogamy is the story of Annie and Graham, happily married for 30 years. But after Graham dies suddenly, Annie discovers he was having an affair. Annie spirals into darkness, wondering if she ever truly knew the man who loved her. As the Washington Post recently stated, monogamy demonstrates that Sue Miller remains one of the finest cartographers of the territory of marriage. Sue Miller is the best-selling author of 11 novels, including While I Was Gone, The Distinguished Guest, Inventing the Abbots, and of course, The Good Mother. It's a great pleasure to welcome Sue Miller to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Well, and a delight to be here, too. Thank you for asking.
What brought you to this idea of wanting to explore and write about monogamy?
Well, it's interesting to me anyway, just in terms of the various rules that I've lived under in my adult life, in part sort of the rules that are covered in the book a little bit when through the 60s and 70s, at least in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live, the whole notion of an open marriage was something that was not widely promulgated, but a lot of people I knew knew about it, and some of the people I knew were trying it, and most of those people failed at it, actually. But I think that's that sort of notion of whether one needs to be faithful, whether one wants to be faithful, whether one is able to be faithful, is an interesting one in marriage. It runs underneath all of it. And I thought also, for my purposes, it would be an interesting way to explore what a particular marriage meant to its, I guess, participants, I guess you'd say, when one of them sort of stood in violation of what the other one assumed to be the rules for their marriage.
When we meet Annie and Graham, we learn that they have both failed at their first crack at marriage.
Right, right. Graham is someone who embraced the open marriage idea of the 60s and 70s, and his wife agreed with him. He was straightforward with her. But she, his wife's name was Frieda, his first wife. She soon found out that she just really wasn't capable of it in some sense. But she's a sort of a very gentle person. She just couldn't present that to him until it was really too late, and she just had been so deeply wounded by it all that she left, taking their child, a little boy at that point, named Lucas, with her. And then Annie had a very brief young marriage that just failed because in the end she discovered she didn't like her husband very much. Mm. Sort of the Margaret Mead first marriage in which you learn something about marriage and so forth. So they've come together each with a kind of failure in their past, and they're just very charged and happy to meet each other. It's sort of a big surprise to both of them in a way.
And through the 30 years, there is a great deal of honesty, of affairs that happen during the marriage that they do talk about, but a lot they don't talk about.
Yeah, they actually, Andy doesn't know of Graham's marriages. Frieda did, of course, but of Graham's affairs, I'm sorry. But they know each other's past very, very well.
Right.
But they don't, he never confides in her anything. He never confesses to her, I should say, anything about the one affair he's had very, very early on in their marriage, when things, as I say in the novel, things were sort of not so great between him and Annie, and he didn't really understand why. And it was a very brief sort of fling with another married person. But in terms of what's ongoing between them in the novel, he, as the novel begins, is trying to extricate himself from what he understood was going to be another short fling.
Yeah.
And it's turned out to be a little bit harder to get out of than he thought. The woman is sort of holding on to him pretty tight. We find him preoccupied, and we find Annie preoccupied because she's a photographer, and she's having her first solo show in 5 or 6 years, and she's tremendously anxious about the way this show will go, and she's anxious about her future as a photographer, period. So they each have something bothering them when we first encounter them in the first couple of chapters of the book.
Did you always know that Graham was going to be a goner?
Oh, yes. That was part of the whole reason for writing the book, was to sort of look at her grief after he dies, and then complicate her grief by having her discover that he has had an affair, one which she can't discuss with him, one which she cannot know anything further about, but just that he has, she's sure of that. And the way in which that shifts the ground under her feet, really, she finds out about 2 months after his death, and at a sort of memorial gathering for him. And she's up till that point been just genuinely grief-stricken in a very hard way for her, but yearning for him, and calling up memories of him. And then suddenly she discovers that he has had an affair, and she just doesn't know what to do with her feelings. She's so angry at him and feels so betrayed, and yet he's not there to talk about it with her. And she questions everything she understood about their marriage, which seems suddenly open to be sort of reversed. And her whole, the ground under her feet sort of shifts completely, leaving her with just fury, honestly, and then mixed with this grief that she no longer wants to deal with, even. She's so angry. So it was really for me, that was where I was headed. I knew what I wanted to be looking at was Annie's I hate that word process used in this way, but the way she proceeds through the her grieving, and then her turning away from her grieving, and then finally coming to some terms internally about a great deal of it.
I found it fascinating because, as you say, as Graham was trying to extricate himself from this relationship and to keep it to a fling and have it be nothing more, Annie knew something was going on. She was very attuned to him, and knowing that something was, she didn't know that, but she certainly knew that he wasn't the same Graham.
Right. And then actually, he goes to lunch with a very old friend,
right.
And he actually talks about this affair he's been having. And after that, in the first few chapters of the book, he goes to meet with the woman, her name is Rosemary, with whom he's been having this affair. And in what I thought it was a very painful scene, which was sort of wonderful to write, as many painful things are, he extricates himself. And he goes home to Annie, and he's feeling just wonderful. And of course, Annie, when she finds out much later about the affair, has no idea that he's extricated himself, has no idea that he has wanted out almost from the moment he got in. And, presumably it would have been hard anyway, even knowing that, but it's the harder because she really has no idea about that, that Graham was sort of coming back to her, essentially, having freed himself from this affair. So it's just complicated on all sides, what people know, what they don't know, including the children and Frieda, the first wife, who's a friend of Annie's, who's always been in this family circle. And that was part of what I was exploring, too, the way in which we feel we can't tell people things. We need to keep things private. And the difficulties that that poses in terms of people misunderstanding us, in terms of our misunderstanding them. But it's just to, you know, I sort of work around in the family from character to character and try to really examine everything they're feeling about Graham's death and then everything they're feeling about other people's responses to Graham's death and various issues, such as who gets to come to the scattering of the ashes and so forth. So, but it really was a sort of look at the way a family works in the wake of something as cataclysmic as Graham's death, and then how it works differently for Annie after a certain point because her grief has so shifted, but she can't talk to anyone else about it because she doesn't want to tell his children any of that. So for me, these were sort of fascinating aspects of this, the way the whole family related to each other.
Sue Miller is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is Monogamy, and it's published by Harper. I cannot let it go that of what you just said of the enjoyment of writing the painful scenes. What what is that that enjoyment in the sense of really putting yourself into that moment for a while?
You do, but very much with the consciousness that you're writing it, so that there's an awareness that this is a kind of gripping scene, and you want to write it with some restraint, of course, but you're aware that you're hoping that it has a certain effect on the reader. And so you're partly filled with, if it's going well, with sort of the joy of knowing that it will have a kind of gripping effect on the reader. And so in some ways, just the awfulest scenes in fiction are the ones that I think as a writer, you're aware of the power of, and that gives you pleasure as you're writing it. You know, you sort of rub your hands together and say, aha, this is going to be so, you know, terrific. evil. We're just evil. I mean, you know, killing people off and, you know, the death scene or the discovery of the death. Mm. Those things are, you know, you're trying to do two things at once, sort of internally as a writer, I think. You're trying to feel the difficulty and the pain of the scene, but you're also aware that you're trying to, in some sense, convey that to the reader and move the reader. And that's a very exciting thing to be trying to do.
And you know it's important. You know that it has to work for what is to come later.
Absolutely. And you also don't want to go overboard. You don't want to be, you know, manipulative, and although in some way or another you are. But, I mean, you don't want to be crassly manipulative and using things that 1,000 people have said before that are sort of not original or heartfelt on your part, so that they can't be heartfelt on the character's part either, it seems to me. It's a difficult thing to be, you know, you're your own reader, in effect, and then you're also the writer. And so you're sort of trying to stand in two places at the same time. But if you feel it's going well, it's thrilling.
There's all these worlds that you dip into, too. As you mentioned, Annie is a photographer, so that's interesting. Graham runs a bookstore as a bookseller, an independent bookseller in Boston, which is fascinating in that life. Graham and Annie's daughter, Sarah, works for an NPR affiliate in San Francisco. God love her. So all that is cool, too.
Yeah, no, it was interesting to sort of make them, that part of making them real was making them have work that they cared about. The son is a little bit, Lucas, the son that Graham has had with Frieda, his first wife, is a little bit vaguer, and he's not entirely happy in his work, it turns out, and he's about to change it towards the end of the book. But it was interesting to have the others be at work a little bit, and have work that really was compelling to them. You know, there's a whole little passage when Graham returns to the bookstore after he's had lunch with a friend I spoke of earlier, and just walking in feels this great rush of love for the story itself. Just every aspect of it is very quickly sketched in and talked about, you know, including opening the new books and the way they reading the, you know, the bio at the back and the dedication and that sort of stuff. So he just is, he loves every aspect of it. It's also connected to a kind of wonderful, compelling, garrulous, ebullient quality he has, which is that he just loves people, and the bookstore sort of is people. One of the things that he and Annie have together, happily as a married couple, is that when someone comes to read at the bookstore, Graham usually asks that person over for dinner and gathers some other people around. And Annie, who's a great, great cook, interested in food, cooks, and they have this series of parties, which is just part of their life, of people sitting around talking. And then as Graham is thinking about it, he remembers the old days when they also danced a lot and that sort of stuff. So he's made a very nice life around his work. Annie's work is more fraught because she's always anxious about success in a certain way. And then Sarah's work is just sketched in, really, but it, through her work, she meets a very important character with whom she becomes involved. So, and who's present at the moment she hears of her father's death, actually.
At one point, about halfway through the novel, Annie is talking to a friend and says, "Do you remember his," meaning Graham's, "argument about fiction?" And the friend doesn't, but she said, "Just that we read fiction because it suggests that life has a shape and we feel consoled." I think he said by that notion, consoled to think that life isn't just one damn thing after another, that it has sequence and consequence. I think it was more or less the idea that fictional narrative made life seem to matter, that it pushed away the meaningless of death. Had you thought about that as you were going through this again, not to use your word of process, but of this or in your work of having written so much about relationships?
I think, well, this too, but I mean, I think that is sort of the nature of my work in some way, mostly character-based, and that's what I like to explore. I like to try to make the characters feel as real as they possibly can. And I've also thought about the fact that fiction does give more shape to life than life itself seems to have. And Annie goes on to say in that particular conversation with her friend, you know, that she says, well, look at his life. I mean, she's grieving, so this is part of it. She's feeling kind of the senselessness of life at this point. She says he was, and he was, and he was, and then he wasn't. It's over. You know, just this sense that he's just gone.
All nothing left.
And,
right.
And there's nothing left of him. And then her friend tries to persuade her that there are things left of him. And he's, you know, our memories and the bookstore and the children and so forth. And it's just no consolation at that moment to Annie at all. But I think it's true that fiction surely has more shape than most of our experiences in life do. Because the writer has to give it some shape or another. Essentially, or it doesn't work as fiction.
I was just curious as to when you came to that understanding of the power of that shape.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it must have been why I love fiction so much. I mean, and always have as far back as I can remember, and why I wanted to write it. I mean, of course, the earliest version of that is, "And they lived happily ever after." I mean, right. You know, that wonderful, you know, making complete sense of life, which makes no sense at all, as anyone who's lived past the age of 10 years old knows. But, you know, that's in a way, I think, what fiction still does, even if it isn't the reassuring notion that we had from most fiction when we were little or younger. It's sort of an obligation of fiction, it almost seems to me, just to make some sense out of it, no matter what the terms are, to make some sense in some way out of what the writer's presented to you. Why are these people together? What is it that we're meant to look for? And what is it we're meant to see? And how is it meant to make us feel? Those questions are, I think, ones at the heart of the enterprise, and the enterprise of reading, too. So.
I want to also ask you about some of the contemplations in the novel about parenting. It seems that there is a slightly detached, not detached maybe, but a not the closest of relationships between Annie and her daughter. Lucas mm-hmm. struggles with that with his child, and in thinking of whether he can be a father. And I certainly understand mm-hmm. that much of that is natural, but it does seem to be a theme as well.
I think it is, but I think it's also, I mean, in fact, in the ways it's interesting to me, was interesting to me to sort of present one of the aspects of this large family that includes two women, the ex-wife and the wife, is that the children, as they're growing up, each choose the other person's mother to be a confidant and to be someone that he or she can lean on, so that Sarah essentially chooses Frida to help her through a lot of the stuff that she goes through. She's a kind of overweight, big, loud child, sort of another version of Graham, which doesn't work so well in a female kid. And she has a hard time making it through her adolescence. But Frida is just someone who just accepts her as she is. And Lucas has a hard time with Frida because he's sort of at some basic level angry at her and that she doesn't live with his father anymore. He just yearns for his father, and his father lives with Annie and Sarah in a house nearby, but it doesn't have him really. And to him, that's a failing on Frida's part. And so he chooses Annie. He goes over often, and there's several scenes where he's calling up something that happened, talking to her. And so I think that I feel as though it is hard and complicated families. And mothers are often very hard for kids, it seems to me. They're the ones who more often, because their task is impossible, disappoint. But it's true that Annie and Sarah in particular are too different, really. And actually, Annie's impulse to try to get things smooth and sort of put them behind her is something that Sarah objects to and talks about later in the book as an adult. And what she says is that her mother needs to make things better right away. Can't stand it for you to be sad and so forth. And so she's just sort of always trying to fix the thing up. Let's do this. Let's plan that, you know. Whereas Graham, whose life has been more complicated than Annie's in his youth and so forth, Sarah says of him that he seems to know that there are things that can't be fixed. And he sits with you in your sorrow, the unfixable sorrow. And she feels that that's so important, that he's just this great comfort. And that's what she's felt towards him as she's grown up, that, you know, he understands life better than Annie does in some way.
I do also want to talk about a relationship that we have talked around but not specifically about, and that is the relationship between Annie and Frida. You've talked about them and their attributes. It is interesting that you have these two wives of this man who have their ups and downs, certainly, but do become friends, and very, very good friends.
They are. And actually, I sort of described sort of the things that they've gone through. And one is that both had mothers who about the same time were falling ill with Alzheimer's disease and dying. And so they talked a lot about that with each other. And also this business of the children finding comfort with the other, which might, I suppose, have been a problem in some worlds, but I think each of them knew that each mother knew that her child was having difficulty with her, and so was grateful for the sense that the child was finding comfort with someone else, and that it was okay, that things were going to be okay. They really used each other in that way, and each was grateful for the other's presence in her child's life. And then also just over the years, they just grew close because Frida was just there, welcomed by Graham, who really wanted them to be close. And Annie was a little skeptical at first, but has drawn over the years very close to Frida. Their relationship gets very complicated after Graham's death and after Annie finds out that he's had an affair because Graham has confided an affair to Frieda at an earlier point. There's some confusion on Frieda's part, actually, which was also delicious to write, about which affair is being discussed, because she assumes when Annie comes and tells her, right, or mentions this affair, that it's this one that happened long ago that Graham told her about. And she doesn't know about the recent one. And it's just this sort of great complicated thing where they're talking at cross purposes, and then it only slowly dawns on Frieda that there's a second affair that she hadn't known about, actually. So that at that point, Annie gets very angry at Frieda, too. So there's a real, a very complicated situation where, you know, she says, "Did you know about this affair?" And Frieda says, "Yes," because she's thinking of this long, long ago affair. And so Annie is just furious that Graham talked to Frieda about it somehow, and that Frieda, you know, heard it and said nothing to her. And, you know, it's just this very, each of them talking across purposes during a very hard and complicated discussion of this, Annie's discovery of this affair. Which, you know, I liked writing that too, because I like writing a passage where one person understands what they're talking about differently from what the other person's understanding is. And there's a kind of juggling act, I guess, almost involved in that, that feels like fun, although it's describing very, very painful, a very painful issue.
I also found it interesting that these two women obviously were married to the same man, and often we will roll our eyes when people break up in a relationship and say, well, hopefully we can remain friends. But Graham and they do remain friends. They are able to remain friends, and in fact, she even teases him that don't forget I'm the one who left.
Right, it's at one point. Yeah, I mean, he sometimes calls her the first Mrs. McFarlane, and but I think he loves people, and he needs people to love him, and that's some of it, surely. And he loves her. I mean, later in the book, she remembers that he, you know, on a birthday, he would come over with gifts for her. And when her father died, he, you know, came over and sat with her until she felt she could go to sleep when she was terribly upset with it. And he's just been a presence, a generous presence in her life. His generosity is complicated because, as he calls himself, you know, a fat, needy man. And he needs her to still feel affection for him. He just is someone who absolutely needs people to like him, if not love him. And he works at that, actually, and that's part of his relationship with Frieda, is his wish for her to stay connected to him and to be his friend.
Well, the name of the new novel is Monogamy. It is published by Harper. Sue Miller, what a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, thank you. These were great questions to try to answer.
Thank you very much. Be well. Mm-hmm. Sue Miller's new novel is Monogamy. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, or you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.